Hello, and welcome to The Commissioner. My name is Randy Sawson. This is Episode 8, Tidbits 1, featuring Prince, Sting, and Busta Rhymes. This episode is slightly different in that I'm going to tell a story from a few different videos. Not every video has an interesting tale about the entire process, but there are parts of, or as I'm calling them, tidbits, that are worth talking about. I made a lot of videos, so I want to be able to talk about all the interesting stories as well as the in-depth look at certain videos. And this seemed like the best way to do it. So let's get started into our first story, which is from the Busta Rhymes in the Ghetto music video. I call this tidbit the $10,000 cheeseburger. Okay, so this was the first time that I had commissioned a video by myself for Busta Rhymes. He was at another label, Elektra, for years, and used a person that I liked and respected named Simran to commission his videos. Simran and I did work together to do the Touch It remix video that Busta did just prior to this video in the ghetto. Touch It was a big hit, and then the remix was going to be was a big hit as well. Featured a bunch of different rappers on it. But there was an issue at the Touch It remix video when someone in Busta's entourage was shot and killed on the set of that video. And Simran was the commissioner on set as it was filmed in New York. It made sense at the time to save money because she lived in New York, so she went to the video set. I'll get into full details of that video in another episode, but needless to say, when it came to commissioning this video, she didn't really want to participate, and I was on my own as the sole commissioner. We hired Chris Robinson to direct the video, and he came up with a great concept, and that we're able to cleverly film the video in Los Angeles, but make it feel like it was filmed on the streets of New York where Busta was from, and because he wanted it to feel like New York. But for some reason, we just couldn't all get there. It was a lot cheaper and easier to do it in L.A. The day started out great. I just come from a six-week shoot of a feature film that I produced called Live, starring Eva Mendez, which is a cool movie if you get a chance to check it out. Either way, this is my first video back in a bit, so I wanted it to go smoothly, and everything was going smoothly, and we were underway, and we filmed a few setups right out of the box, and Chris Robinson, the director, had commissioned a graffiti artist to paint a beautiful wall image that featured the image of Rick James, and as the song was a sample of Rick James in the ghetto, and Rick had passed away already, but his voice was featured on the track. So we wanted to have, something. So he had this beautiful mural painted, and we were setting up to do a performance of Busta in front of the mural before lunch. And we had about 45 minutes before lunch. And I noticed everything was pretty much set, but we weren't shooting. So I walked over to Chris Robinson and I was like, "Are we ready to shoot? What are we waiting on?" And he said, "Just waiting on talent, sir." And I was like, "Oh," and so, I realized that it was, we were waiting on Busta. So I was trying to get the shot in before lunch so we could stay on schedule. And I realized that was my cue to go get Busta and bring him to set so we could film the scene and move on with our day. But as it turns out, that was easier said than done. When I walked over to Busta's trailer, I saw the producer, a good friend of mine and someone I work with a lot back then, a guy named Billy Parks, was talking to a few people, and I asked him, what are we waiting on? And he said there was an issue with Busta and that Busta was refusing to leave the trailer. So I asked what the issue was, and he said that Busta and his squad wanted cheeseburgers. So I told him to get cheeseburgers. And here's where everything goes awry. He told me that the caterer had brought high-end food like steak and salmon, but did not have any ground beef and was not able to make any cheeseburgers on location. Just a quick note, when you're on location and you have a catering for the caterer usually brings enough food for the entire cast and crew, which is about 80 people or maybe 100 people. But in order to do that, they have to prepare meals and they don't have a lot of space to do that in, right? So they kind of pre-prepare everything. So they didn't have a meat grinder on the catering truck to make ground beef. This seemed like a simple misunderstanding, so I told Billy I'd go talk to Buster in his trailer and sort this out. He said, great, good luck. Little did I know what I was walking into. I knocked on the door and went into Buster's trailer. He immediately started yelling at me. He's like, did you hear the caterer won't give us cheeseburgers? This is some racist shit. I'm gonna, you know, like, I'm not performing in this video. And I was like, oh, whoa, 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 whoa. And he came at me really hard, you know, and so I wasn't expecting it, but I immediately tried to reason with him. I was like, I told him that it wasn't that the caterer wouldn't serve cheeseburgers. It was just that they didn't have the equipment to make them. They had steak and salmon, but no cheeseburgers. And this got Busta even madder. He accused me of trying to be clever and trick him. And he told me he didn't want steak or salmon. He wanted a fucking cheeseburger. And I have worked with Busta a lot at this point, but I know he's an intense, passionate artist. And he does have a tendency to yell at people, especially if he's unhappy. And I could also tell that trying to reason with him wasn't going to work. Like, I wasn't going to get anywhere. So I told him that I understood what he wanted and I was going to get him his cheeseburgers as soon as possible. I didn't really have an issue with that. You know, I understood they wanted him. So I was like, I was going to do it. I just wanted to get him on set to perform so we didn't go into meal penalty. And, you know, on a film set, when you have to feed your crew every 6 hours. So usually there's a meal when you get there, breakfast, it's kind of before call time. And let's say the call time's at 7 a.m. So lunch would have to be called at 1 p.m. And then if you do from 1 to 2. So at 2 o'clock, you start again. If you don't wrap by 8 o'clock, you have to have what is known as a second meal, you know. And that's to feed the crew. You feed them every 6 hours. And that is just the rule of thumb, and you have to do that. And sometimes you can get a crew to give you like a 15-minute grace period, which means that if you're in the middle of shooting a scene and it makes sense to finish the scene rather than calling lunch and coming back and trying to do it all, the crew will give you a grace, but it's usually a shot or two, and it takes, you know, between 5 and 10 minutes. And so you're a little bit over, and usually you're breaking people that aren't essential. So you start lunch and then the people that are on set get to catch up. And they call it grace, and you can get that. But you can't do that when you have an entire sequence to shoot. You have to be in the middle or almost done with a setup in order to do that. So we're about 30 minutes before lunch. So I had to get Buster on set in order to get him even close to making this happen. I told Busta I would get him the cheeseburgers, but in the meantime, could he just go out and film the scene? And this got him even more upset. He got right in my face, and he told me that he didn't want just want cheeseburgers. He wanted this caterer to make him cheeseburgers, and he wouldn't leave his trailer until he saw a tray of cheeseburgers made by the caterer in his trailer. And I knew there was nothing that I could do to change his mind, so I just left the trailer. I went to Billy. I was like, can you get a PA to go to the grocery store? He told me that they were already doing it and the PA was buying stuff for the caterer. I also knew that this would not happen in the time we needed. It's like, it's going to take 15 minutes to get there and another 15 minutes for it to get back and make the cheeseburgers. And so that meant we were definitely going into a meal penalty, and that we would also mean we'd probably be behind schedule. And so there was going to be some overtime at the end of the day, of which, you know, we were going to have to figure out how to pay for this. So I told Billy to start getting me numbers so I knew what the cost of the situation would be. And he told me he was working on them. I remember going to Busta's manager, Mona, and explaining the situation. And she'd been his manager since the beginning, and she knows him. And she just told me there's no negotiating with him when he gets in this kind of mood, so it was better to just get him the cheeseburgers as soon as possible. And I told her that's what we were doing, you know. So we got the cheese. We got the ingredients to the caterer who made the cheeseburgers, but it still took about 20 minutes. And I returned back to Busta's trailer with a tray of cheeseburgers, and Busta agreed to go to set and do the performance. But we were already behind schedule, and I knew that we were going to go into overtime. And so I had Billy run the numbers, so I knew it would cost. And getting the actual numbers for overage takes some time. And it's not just like adding additional crew. You have location costs and transportation because you have cars, so there's additional hours. And there's a lot of elements that go into what an extra hour of filming costs, not just the crew. The tray of cheeseburgers sat untouched in his trailer. They were never eaten, and his entourage and him went to catering after the setup and ate the delicious meal that was prepared, and he even complimented the caterer. Buster came up later and apologized, which was fine. I realized he was just in a mood, and I was more than happy to accept his apology. I didn't even make that big of a deal about it. But it was just one of those funny things where, like, I mean, I'll never forget when he was like, I don't just want cheeseburgers. I want that caterer to make me cheeseburgers. It was one of those moments of like, okay, here we go. Anyways, like I said before, this was not my issue. And I understood that he was frustrated and then felt like he was being disrespected, but which was not the case. But when someone feels a certain way, no matter how much you try and tell them it's wrong, they can't or won't hear it or understand it. And that was one of those times. So I just wanted to move on and make a great video, which we did. As lunch was finishing, Billy came up to me, sat down across from me, and told me he had the final numbers for the overage. And he slid a piece of paper with a full breakdown of all the costs. And the total number, $10,000. And I looked at the paper, and then I looked back at Billy, and I said, well, at least now we know how to make a $10,000 cheeseburger. This next segment is called Watching a Video with Your Ears. The year was 1995, and Moonlight, this is Sting's Moonlight video, was the first of 10 videos that I made with Sting as his video commissioner. It was a song from the movie Sabrina that starred Harrison Ford, Greg Kinnear, and Julia Ormond, and the film was directed by Sidney Pollack for Paramount Pictures. The music video was directed by Mike Figgis, who had just finished a film called Leaving Las Vegas that starred Nicolas Cage and Elizabeth Shue, which got Mike Figgis an Academy Award nomination that year for Best Director and Best Screenplay. I was relatively new to the job of commissioner, and Sting is a major artist to this day and was one of, if not the biggest artist on the roster at A&M Records at the time. The video was shot in London in one day on a soundstage and went off without any issues. The story here has to do with the edit and how you make videos for songs from a soundtrack. Soundtracks were a much bigger deal before streaming music became the mode of distribution. One of the biggest selling records of all time is the official soundtrack for Saturday Night Fever. At A&M Records, we had an A&R person whose sole job was to develop and release soundtracks, John McHugh. And A&M had done the soundtrack for like The Breakfast Club and had a huge hit with the Simple Minds song, Don't You Forget About Me. They also did the soundtrack for a movie called Empire Records that was great and had a minor hit with Edwin Collins called Never Met a Girl Like You Before. Bryan Adams, another one of A&M's biggest artists, who I was fortunate enough to make 10, 12 baby videos with, and he'll be featured in a future episode of Tidbits, had the theme song from a Robin Hood movie with Kevin Costner and Christian Slater called Everything I Do that was a massive worldwide smash. So this was a big business for the label and a top priority as well. And one of the issues, or should I say potential issues, is the process. What I mean is that since you're working with a partner, in this case, Paramount Pictures, and they're paying for half the cost for making the video, they're involved in the process. The money usually isn't the issue, as studios have a much bigger budget to market the movies than a label does has even to make and release a video. So, but like I discussed in episode 3, after, you know, making Marmalade, Lady Marmalade for Moulin Rouge, you have to work with and please the studio. They're your partners in the process. This was not really an issue at all in the pre-production or during the filming of the video. The studio was really easy to deal with and just wanted to make sure that we used selected shots from the movie in the actual video, which is how it usually goes and not a problem. On our side, we were fine with all that. We finished the shoot, got a good rough cut, sent the video over to Paramount for approval. And this is the part of the story where the commissioner saves the day. So So I received a call from the CEO of A&M Records, Al Cafaro. I always had a great relationship with Al and loved working with and for him. And he told me there was an issue with the video and that I should call our contact at Paramount and deal with it. Like any good boss, he was telling me there was an issue and wanted me to take care of it. And he didn't need the details or specifics. He was like, just take care of this. So I immediately called over to Paramount and I was told that Sidney Pollack, the director of the movie Sabrina, had an issue with the video. They couldn't be specific, but he would not approve the video as is. So I asked if there was any way to talk, you know, to Sidney about it. Then they said they'd let me know and get back to me. And within an hour, I got a call from Sidney's office and they wanted to know if we could schedule a meeting for me to come over and meet with Sidney and discuss the video. I was more than happy to do that. As a matter of fact, I was excited. Sidney Pollack is one of my favorite directors. He directed They Shoot Horses, Don't They?, The Way We Were, 3 Days of the Condor, Absence of Malice, Tootsie, and Out of Africa, to name but a few. So the opportunity to go have a meeting with him under any circumstance was something that I jumped at. And we set up a meeting at his office on the Paramount lot for the next day. I remember pulling up to the guard gate at the Paramount lot. Living in Los Angeles, going to a meeting at a film studio is always amazing to me anyways. If you work on a lot, then maybe it gets old, but I've never worked at a film studio as a permanent employee, so I always love pulling up to the guard gate, giving them my name and ID, and getting my credentials. And this time it was kind of a big deal as I was going to have a meeting with Sidney Pollack. I was given my clearance and they directed me to his bungalow on the lot. And just a quick note, having a bungalow on a film lot is probably the most prestigious thing you can have in the film industry. It means that you're part of the company, but you have your own entity within the structure. And since Sidney had so many successful movies for Paramount, he had an amazing bungalow with parking, which is always at a premium on a film lot. Anyways, I pulled up to the bungalow, parked in the visitor parking, and went in the bungalow. And I was a little nervous, not because I was meeting Sidney Pollack, who I loved and respected. I was excited about that. I was nervous because no one could tell me why Sidney wanted to have this meeting and what his issues were with the video. And I walked in and Sidney was on the phone and he didn't have an assistant or anyone else there. And he motioned for me to sit down on the couch in the middle of the room and he continued his conversation. And when he finished, he introduced himself and I stood up and shook his hand, told him I was a big fan. And he was genuinely appreciative. I kind of referenced a few movies and he asked me my name again. He's like, well, what's your name? Randy. Yeah, okay, great, Randy. Great, thanks for coming, you know? And he asked me if I brought a copy of the video, which I did. I had a VHS copy of the video with burnt in time code. And time code are numbers that that are on the edit and you put like in the picture for reference. So this is a way for you to look at the video and have a specific shot with a number reference so you can tell the editor what to change and where to change it, you know? It doesn't go in the final thing. It's just for reference. So anyways, he took the VHS from me and he lamented what a shitty format it was. He told me, imagine being a director and sweating all the details on set only to see your work distilled down to this shitty piece of tape playing on a crappy tube TV. You know, I told him I felt his pain and I was here to help any way I could. And he explained to me that the issue he had with the video was not the quality or even the film footage. He just didn't understand the edit at all. So we put in the video and immediately he started talking about why are they, you know, having issues? Why are they cutting here? What makes, I don't understand. She's not even finished with the movement, you know? And I could tell right away that he was watching the video and not listening to the song. He looked at me and asked if I understood his issues, and I told him I did. I rewinded the VHS and told him that I would try and explain the edit, but before I did, that I wanted him to try and understand the general premise when it comes to music videos. I told him that most viewers of MTV or music videos in general watch a music video with their ears and not their eyes. And Sidney immediately recoiled, but took that in, and he told me to repeat that. He was like, say that again. So I did. And he looked me straight in the eyes and he said, thank you. Thank you for explaining that to me. He said, no one's ever said it to me like that. And it makes sense. He goes, there's a whole generation of viewers that look at film differently. And I never understood why, but now I get it. He said they watch video with their ears. Yeah, that makes sense. And he told me to stop the video and that he would let the studio know it was approved. Literally, he made no more changes. He still hated the video, but he's like, I'll never understand this medium, so I'm just going to let it go. He thanked me for coming over, and I told him if he ever wanted to make a video, I would love to work with him. He told me that I couldn't afford him and that he would stick to making movies, but that if he ever considered one, I would be his first choice. I left the meeting, went back to the office. I got a call from Al, my CEO, saying that Sydney approved the video and loved the meeting. It was a major accomplishment and the first of many times I had to figure out a situation without the best material to make it work. The truth was, the video was not that great, and I didn't want to offend a professional hero of mine. So while you can acknowledge someone's issues, you cannot easily change the way that people ingest content. It's more pertinent today. And that is the story of how I explained how people watch music videos with their ears. The final story for this episode is called, I don't know, it's my name. This is for the Prince Love Sign video. This was not the only time I worked with Prince, but it was the only time that I was an executive producer and a video commissioner. This song was from the 1-800 New Funk compilation release that Prince did in 1994. And this was at the height of his fight with Warner Brothers Records over the fact that he was under contract and felt that he was being mistreated. He changed his name to a symbol and went by the moniker The Artist Formerly Known as Prince. The record came out on NPG Records, which was his own label, and I represented Ice Cube as a director. So we worked directly with Paisley Park to conceive, produce, and commission this video. And the shoot went fine. We had a couple of setups with Prince in good spirits. He's not the most talkative person and doesn't really interact with anyone outside his immediate circle. He has a lot of security and they do most of the talking for him. This included letting me know that Prince wanted to buy the prop chair that you see in the video that he was using for his performance as the radio DJ in the video. The video was a story about Prince and Nona Gay, Marvin's daughter in real life, and they fall in love even though she's hired to take him down as he is the voice of dissension on a radio station that's creating issues for the government. We shot a bunch of scenes with Nona and we were getting ready to film Prince in the booth performing as the DJ. As this video was done directly with Prince and MPG, there was no real commissioner, but I was trying to help out doing both. And I was repping Cube as the director for the video. So we did a few takes and Prince was great. But we were having some issues with the lighting as he was moving around the entire DJ booth while he was performing. So we had to move some lights and create a more even lighting setup that wouldn't leave any shadows or show the source of the lights. This is an important part of lighting any film setup where you want to make sure that you have the subjects lit properly, but you don't want to see a shadow or the source of where the light's coming from. So, or it takes you out of the scene. You kind of see where the lights are. So this is going to take about 15, 20 minutes to move a few lights and reset some flags that go around the lights. And Prince decided to stay on set rather than go back to his dressing room, which was just a little office we had in the building. And I went in to check on him and saw that his feet were up on the desk and Ice Cube was in the room too. So Cube was talking to him, told his performance was great and to keep up his energy. And Prince just nodded. You know, he's obviously done this many, many times. He's been around the block. But then Cube looked at Prince's feet up on the desk. And Prince had these custom-made Beetle boots that had the symbol that he was using for his name as the pull tab for the zipper. And there's a close-up of them in the video. And it was because of this little exchange that they're in there in the first place. So Cube flicked the symbol on Prince's boot and goes, yo, what's this? And Prince was like, what's what? You know? And Cube flicked it again and said, this, the symbol hanging from your boot. And this was like the burning question that everyone wanted to know the answer to. What does it mean? Was there an actual name Would he tell us how to pronounce it? You know, you could literally cut the tension with a knife. We all just sat there for an uncomfortable moment, long uncomfortable moment, and then Prince looked at Cube, and with a wry, shy smile, he said, "I don't know, it's my name." And then there was like another uncomfortable silence, and it was definitely one of those moments where you think something weird or bad could happen, but it didn't. Cube just kind of nodded and smiled and was like, "That's cool." And then he told the AD to come in. He said, "Yo, we're going to do a close-up on these boots while we wait for the lighting to get set up for the wide shot. You know, we got to let people know his name." And Prince just sat there and smiled. He asked the security person to get him some water. And we set up the shot of the close-up of the boots. We were all hoping that he would tell us how to pronounce the symbol. But he was smarter than that. He just left us with more questions, but somehow feeling satisfied that we got an answer to our questions. Anyways, the video was played a lot on BET, and it helped Prince establish his own identity and break free from Warner Brothers during the contract dispute, as he could establish his independence as his own artist. And I left to become the commissioner of A&M Records shortly after the shoot, and I didn't see Cube again until we worked together on the Players Club soundtrack that he released on A&M, with the lead song being We Be Clubbin'. And as for Prince, I never work with him again in that capacity, but I will always have this moment where he told me the secret without revealing anything. Well, that's episode 8, Tidbits 1, featuring Prince, Sting, and Busta Rhymes. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. Please leave your questions or comments. Links to all three of the videos discussed here are in the description of this episode, so you can click on it and watch them there. Also, please share and let people know about this podcast. We're growing every day, but always want new listeners. My name is Randy Sawson, and this is The Commissioner. As always, I'll leave you with this. Whenever a dating app works well, it loses two users.